I think it started out, when we started doing it, it was, we tried to recreate our pub chats, basically. And we soon figured out that that doesn't actually work that well.
Yeah, we did one long lost episode. In fact, there's no trace of it anymore.
Yeah.
Where we did it with alcohol involved.
We really tried to recreate the pub atmosphere.
And we didn't have a plan. We just went, all right, let's chat. What do you want to talk about? Let's talk about the silent way. Okay. It fell flat.
It was terrible. And Rob's computer recognized how bad it was and somehow
spat it out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Hi, and welcome to ELT WTF. This week, WTF stands for What Tefalologists Feel. This episode was recorded in November last year, the day before the JALT conference, and I met up with two-thirds of the Tefalology crew, Matthew Turner and Matthew Schaefer. If you don't know, Tefalology is perhaps the longest-running, most successful ELT podcast out there. If you've not listened to it before, I strongly recommend turning this off and taking a listen. The Tefalology podcast, and also their book, Podcasting and Professional Development, are big inspirations for this podcast, so I took advantage of the opportunity to ask them about podcasting. But because it was the Friday before a conference weekend, I started by asking about their plans for the weekend. We're here in Tokyo the day before the JALT conference, and so this is my first JALT conference. It's not my first time in Japan, but you guys are fairly seasoned JALTers. So do you guys have any kind of tips or tricks?
I would strongly suggest, you know, having a look through the program beforehand and you know, deciding what you want to see. You know, you'll find that there's five things you want to see that are all going on at the same time, and you'll find there's, you know, you have like 2 hour stretches where there's nothing you want to see. But that's when you go for a walk, you get lunch or whatever.
For me, some of the most interesting things about conferences are, yes, seeing your friends, seeing people that you know and like, but also meeting new people. And I think this is the one thing that I always tell myself before each conference. Make sure you spend more time trying to make some more connections. I remember last year, I sat with Rob, actually. But I basically sat with Rob for like 2 hours chatting, and I was like, I can do this anywhere, anytime. So this year I'm going to make a conscious effort not to spend too much time
with Rob.
Well, not just Rob. So you just get around a bit, meet a few new people, and try and...
And I think also, be open to meeting people anywhere. I think it was last year at JALT, I was in the queue for getting the coffee, and I started chatting to the guy in front of me, and it wasn't a great connection, but what I did find out is he was an older guy. He had worked with my father like 25 years ago. In Japan,
just this,
just this really random coincidence. Yeah.
I always try and ask at least one question after the presentation, and I try to go up to the speaker afterwards if they're not busy, and say, "Oh, like, I enjoyed what you were talking about," and I respect that if people do that to me. So I think it's good. What's the word? Good conduct. I don't know, I like the personable aspect of conferences. Yeah. I don't like this go in, get what you want and leave. I like going in and interacting with people.
A lot of the best stuff happens in the coffee shop or something anyway. Yeah. So what have you guys got planned for this weekend? Have you got any special activities lined up?
We're doing our forum that we've done the past 2 years now. Slightly different theme this year. We always work with the conference theme. Conference themes are always a bit suspect. But this year there's a good theme, I think. Diversity and inclusion. It's very inclusive of everything. So we're doing our forum where we do the same as we did last year, where we bring different people from perhaps different fields or different areas of our field together, and we interview them, and then we kind of make connections, find out what the overlaps and commonalities are.
That was my favourite bit of the one last year, was hearing people were like, wouldn't normally be talking about like feminism in teaching. All of a sudden they had to kind of jump in on something, was really interesting to kind of hear those connections. So let's talk a bit about podcasting, because that's kind of the meat of why we're here. Can you kind of give me a bit of a brief history of your podcast and kind of how that started up?
Oh, maybe you should start, actually. You and Rob had the first
Yeah, well, we way back, maybe 2010, Rob and I were working together. I've got this on tape. I've got a little audio recording of us saying this, but we were lesson planning together. And we kind of were like, these conversations are really interesting that we're having about lesson planning. This is kind of way before I got interested in reflective practice. So we were like, oh, we should record what we're talking about now. And I think I said something like, we should put it out as a podcast. And then that little idea kind of sat tucked away, dormant in our brains for like 4 years. And then when we met Matt, I don't know, we realized that we enjoyed spending time with each other.
Yeah, and we would go out for drinks after work and start off by talking about movies and, you know, anything else. And then the evening would always end with us talking about teaching, basically.
Yeah.
And we realized even when we don't have to, we spend a lot of our time talking about teaching. And I don't, you know, I think like Rob, maybe not you so much, but Rob and I had already had a long history of listening to podcasts at that point. And then I guess you guys brought up, I think you brought up the idea of doing a podcast, and then again, it lay dormant for a few months.
Sure, yeah.
But then we decided just to go for it.
Yeah, so I think the main motivation was basically we like podcasts and we wanted to see if anyone would enjoy listening to our conversations about teaching.
I guess we were also aware of, at the time, a little bit of a gap in the market.
Yeah. I remember doing a Google search or an iTunes search, and we came across a few podcasts that are kind of discontinued or defunct.
Yeah. And because I was going to ask about this. So in your book, you talk a bit about the history of ELT podcasting. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
So this iTunes search that I did, there are at least two or three that I can remember, and both of them had finished maybe 5 years previous or 4 years previous. Can't remember any names. Maybe, they kind of struck me as being not very good quality, not very interesting. And they were mostly actually for learners. Most of the podcasts are for learners, not for other teachers. So that was the big gap that we saw.
Yeah, first. Yeah. When you do try to do a search in iTunes or whatever, obviously you come up with hundreds of language learning podcasts. Podcasts for learners, but very few for teachers. I imagine that as you said, the ones that we did find that were for teachers, their last episode had been several years previous, and they hadn't released any episodes since. I imagine it's probably the same for podcasts in all genres. That's why, like, restaurants, you know.
Yeah.
90% of them don't last the first year.
So we established a niche, and we felt that was a good gap to exploit and kind of get our name in there, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so apart from kind of the gap in the market, what appeals to you about podcasting? Because you guys could have set up a blog together, or you guys could have done any number of things together. Why did you pick podcasting?
I mean, like you said, you know, it was sitting around talking to people that you like talking to, and that appealed to us. I think it started out, when we started doing it, we tried to recreate our pub chats, basically. And we soon figured out that doesn't actually work that well.
Yeah, we did one long lost episode. In fact, there's no trace of it anymore.
Yeah.
Where we did it with alcohol involved.
We really tried to recreate the
And we didn't have a plan. We just went, all right, let's chat. What do you want to talk about? Let's talk about The Silent Way. Okay. It fell flat.
It was terrible. And Rob's computer recognized how bad it was and somehow
spat it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And when we did decide, once we realized that we had to put the effort in, prepare for it, we probably were hoping that we could just get away with showing up in somebody's flat and recording it. And then we realized we couldn't. So we thought, okay, we'll put the work in. We'll go away. We'll prepare it. And we sort of hit on this, the current structure we have where we all go off and do a little bit of research for the different segments we bring. And I think at the time, I don't know how you guys felt. I wonder how sustainable this is.
And there was a comment way back from one of our early adopters. I remember him writing a comment. I'm not sure if it was in an email to us or on Twitter. He said, oh, they're going to run out of things to talk about quickly.
I think it was that. And also, like, I hope you don't, like, burn out by doing all this research, prep for a new episode. Because, it is a bit of extra work. But I think it sort of come back to your question in terms of what about it appeals to us is, and we describe it in the book as, what do we call it, critical co-presentership.
Yeah, yeah.
So this idea of how it's basically, it's a form of reflective practice. You know, we sit down and we talk about these things, and then we reflect on them in the planning process, and then we reflect on them again while we're talking to each other. And I think on the, you know, train home, we probably reflect on it again.
And there's that aspect that is also being broadcast as well.
Mm.
So that adds another dimension to it. Something we can't really put our finger on what it is, but having it recorded and released into the wild gives you a bit of an impetus to speak or want to say the right thing, perhaps. Like, even as we're speaking now, I'm aware that this is going to be going out at some point, so I'm really trying harder to formulate my ideas a bit more clearly.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
Maybe,
It kind of reminds, when I'm studying, sometimes you'll have a homework, it's like, go and read this passage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, go and read this passage and then share your ideas with your peers afterwards. And you read the passage on your own and you're a bit kind of sloppy here and there. But if you have to share it afterwards, I think it really does make a difference.
Yeah.
How has podcasting influenced your lives, both like in terms of teaching, but also like kind of your wider professional lives?
Yeah, well, we were talking about this the other day. I remember in the pub the other day, Rob asked a question like, "What have we actually learned from the podcast?" And hopefully, that's a project of my PhD that I'm going to be doing. So I hope there's a longer answer to this. For me, it's about making connections. We've met you through this, arguably.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone onto Twitter. We have our podcast on Twitter. We have a product that other people want to listen to and engage with us because of. It's brought us to new areas of the field that we probably wouldn't have thought about previously. Mm-hmm. History, for example.
Yep.
Yeah, they're perhaps two examples, maybe.
Yeah, I think the history thing is a really nice example of an area of our field that I probably never would have engaged with before. So one of the segments we do on the podcast every week is TEFL Pioneers. And for that, we have to go and research a person, but it, you know, around that person is a whole aspect of language learning history. And just through doing that, you know, once a month, we sort of piece together. And I think we have a general sense of, you know, some of the evolutionary steps of language learning over the years.
Yeah. And I'd say the podcast has kept us engaged in research because I think for a lot of teachers who are teaching predominantly and are maybe not currently doing an MA or some kind of professional development course, they're probably not engaging with research, I'd say. That's a big sweeping statement.
Yeah.
But so this podcast, for us personally, it's kept us reading, kept us engaged, I'd say.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, like going back to the idea of it being a form of reflective practice, I think it really is. And in my current job involves a lot of different things in like teacher training, curriculum design, all these kinds of things. And, you know, it happens so often that I'm sitting with my fellow managers, the amount of times they've heard me say the phrase, I discussed that on the podcast recently. I'm sure they're kind of bored of that. It's hard to quantify in terms of, you know, it's made me better at this thing, this aspect of my job, but it certainly informed it.
Regarding our interview episodes we do, basically we've reached out to these quite famous TEFLers, I guess, TEFL celebrities, and having a podcast or giving them a reason to write back to us. So.
I always joke about that. I say, like, if I phoned up, or if I message Scott Thorne and say, "Hey Scott, do you fancy a chat next week?" You'll say no, right? But if you say, like, "Oh, would you like to be on the podcast? We'd like to do an interview," like, it's got much more purpose.
Yeah.
Do you find you've made many connections with those people?
I mean, some more than others. But I say if we see them at conferences, they remember and they're happy to share the podcast. One sort of close-ish connection I've started to make is with Tom Farrell, who we've now interviewed twice. And he's a big fan of our podcast. That's a nice connection.
Yeah.
Like you were saying earlier, lots of connections with people who maybe, you know, not necessarily people that we've interviewed, but listeners or, you know, people we've met just through doing the forums that we do and that sort of thing. It's sometimes, you know, some people who we've become so close to that we forget we met them through the podcast at this point.
There's a few other ideas. Yeah. Like, I think our podcast, I think I talked about this at your conference, though, your Excite ELT conference, how podcasts kind of sit in a place between research and practice. They're not like tucked away behind academic paywalls, but the podcasts are kind of made in a way that teachers could understand. So when we interview these people, we're kind of asking the questions on behalf of the teacher. That's what I feel.
One thing I really like, I've been trying to do more with kind of my podcast interviews, is when you guys go and talk to someone, you take a really deep dive. And I think sometimes, like, I've been tempted to just be like, "Let's chat about your life story and this and that and the other." But you also, like, you can take a really deep look. And actually, it's been very helpful for me because, like, I started my master's course very recently, and I don't know how you do it, but every time a reading comes up, one of your podcast episodes will be super relevant to it, and it'll pop up in my inbox pretty soon afterwards. So the episode on anxiety, I'm literally doing anxiety this week, and I was on the plane this morning, and it just came on. It was like the next podcast. Oh, anxiety. Okay, great. It's like a proper dive into the issue. And I think kind of bridging that gap between research and...
And I think we've got better at interviewing.
Yeah, I think
And that's another thing we talked about recently. We're not really sure how our interviewing styles have changed. And I think we all have different interviewing styles. Mm. They definitely have changed.
I think we've gotten better. But what's interesting about, I think, improving interviewing skills is it's basically about improving your listening skills. It's basically sort of forcing yourself to be a better listener and be sort of present and not just always thinking about the next question, that kind of thing, which is really hard to do.
But also at the same time, trying to thread and, I'll skip that question, go to the next. Yeah. And so
does this deserve a follow-up question or should I just, let it go? That's
I also think maybe we've also become a bit less deferential.
Mm.
Our earlier ones, we were very kind of, can we ask you about this? And we didn't really, I feel at least we were a bit too kind, maybe.
We've had discussions, we've gone back and forth, like, we've interviewed people and we definitely disagree with a lot of their ideas, but we never really bring that up and we never really challenge them on those. But I think we're still in a position where we don't think we should. Like, it would be awkward.
Yeah. But it's not a case of disagreeing. I think it's a case of giving them the space to... Mm. Giving them a space to kind of explore their ideas with them. Mm-hmm. And then that's for the listeners to decide later, maybe. And
maybe
we can go away and talk about it.
I think that's our perspective. Yeah, just we're only there to hear their side of things.
Yeah.
Like, we have the regular episodes where we can express our feelings. Yeah. But it also made me, your original question also made me think of something that Mike Griffin said in your interview with him. I think he said something about, if researchers want to make their work more accessible to teachers, write it in a way that's easier for teachers to read and understand. It's not something that we've really gotten into too much with the podcast, but I think for any potential podcasters out there, I think that's a really interesting avenue to take. I guess there are people who do... Somebody's making sort of readable versions of research papers.
Yeah, it's like ELT Research Bites.
And I think a podcast version of that would be great.
Another thing I've realized is the people we interview, they enjoy talking about their work first and foremost. And a few people have said, Steve Mann being one example, he said he really enjoyed rethinking of his ideas that were written in written form a few years ago, having them kind of pulled out again and reformulated as a spoken conversation. He's like, yeah, that's making me question what I said.
Okay, so when you make a podcast and you're kind of listening to the tape back, what would define a successful podcast when you're listening back to that tape?
For me, it doesn't necessarily happen at the stage of listening back, because I never listen back. but we often, once we finish recording, we all have a pretty similar feeling. We all collectively kind of think, that was a good one, or that was not a great one. And I think the good ones are the ones where we feel like, each segment always starts with something, either, a bit of news or a topic or something. And I think the good episodes are the ones where the 10 minutes, whatever it takes to discuss it, we end up somewhere very different from when we started.
You mean, like, different as in...
Not different topics. For example, if I'm talking about giving feedback in the class or something, and I've prepared a bunch of questions about giving feedback, we start that segment, and I have some ideas about giving feedback. But then after talking to you guys... By the end, I have new ideas on feedback or a different perspective on giving feedback.
I mean, like, these segments, we tend to stick to 10 minutes, but we go wildly over that these days. Yeah. Something that's concise, something that captures the main points. Yeah, like you say, something that generates new ideas. Mm. I don't know. There are segments that have fallen flat and we've just got a bit bored talking about them. And I think we can feel that. And I'm pretty sure the listeners can feel that too.
What is interesting is that it's not always obvious which segments are going to fall flat, which segments are going to work. One of us will bring like a news story and we really don't know if it's going to be interesting or not. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes the discussion doesn't really go anywhere and sometimes it ends up being really interesting.
And perhaps another marker of a good segment is when people contact us. And this has happened not so much actually. We've been there's two ways to look at this. We've been lucky that we haven't had a lot of Twitter anger or that kind of thing, which a lot of people get on Twitter, it's a well-documented thing. We've kind of been a bit immune to that, and we haven't had a lot of that, have we? But we have occasionally got the odd email saying I liked what I heard and did you consider that, or on Twitter I disagreed with what you were talking about. You know, there's been a few times where that's happened, and maybe that's a good marker of a topic that generates some sort of interaction.
What do you look for in an interview, both in terms of the person and also like what you're looking to get from that interview?
I think now we try to go for different topics, so topics that we haven't covered, perhaps. Maybe we tend to look less at the person, do you think, and more at the content area?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe a bit of both, depends. Yeah. You know, when we go to conferences, there are a lot of people to choose from in terms of who we contact to try to interview. And yeah, we definitely try to cover areas that we haven't covered, maybe areas that we don't know so much about.
I think it's important to strike a rapport up with them via emails, or if you can meet them beforehand. That's kind of influenced how the interview goes, I think, how well you've kind of got on with them and gelled with them personally.
Of the quite a few people that we've interviewed, we haven't... I can't remember anybody we've interviewed that we've just, like, you know, has frozen up or just hasn't given us good answers or... obviously we're asking them about a topic they know very well, which helps, but yeah, we haven't had any duds so far.
And how do you prepare for an episode? What kind of steps do you take?
Well, for the interviews, this is kind of something that's related to an earlier point. By preparing for these interviews, it's kind of changed the way I read books. So I tend to read books, and rather than writing a comment, I'll write a question. I find that a lot easier to do than make my own comment. I kind of look at a statement and then write a kind of a, or think of a question in my head that I had about that.
A question to the author?
Perhaps. Usually I'm preparing to interview the author, so I find it really easy to put questions together. But I've started doing that when I'm just reading any article, kind of thinking, okay, if I was going to interview this person, what would I ask at this point? So I think when I'm preparing to write something, I think I'm going to continue doing that, basically, just writing questions and seeing what happens.
Whoever is preparing the interview will write about 10 questions. We'll email that round to the other two, get some feedback, maybe add some questions. And that's it, really. Just, you know, set up a time and a place.
Generally speaking, most people are happy with the questions we send, and they're more happier to learn that we've read their books.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not asking kind of... Tell us about this. We're actually kind of questioning them on particular areas or areas of maybe that we don't quite understand ourselves. And so there's a genuine kind of reason for the interview, I guess.
So you sent the questions before?
We try to,
We didn't always, but more recently we've done that. And when we do, we say, like, please don't prepare, you know, any monologue answers to it, and we do tell them that there'll be, you know, some follow up questions that are not on the paper.
I think unanimously everybody agrees to do an interview.
I wonder. I think there was one case where I think maybe we were wondering if the person we might be kind of confrontational with them.
A real Jeremy Paxman.
We're more kind of trying to challenge and push rather than confront.
Yeah, sometimes, I guess. I guess there are some areas where, not worried, but we recently interviewed Michael Swan. Rob and Matt, I think you guys put the questions together, basically. And I remember looking through the questions and thinking, I wasn't sure how we'd react to them, because I felt like they might be a little too challenging. Like the questions seemed to have an implied disagreement, basically, with what we know he thinks about certain issues. But he was very happy to answer the questions.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of purpose of the interviews as well. Often, is it to inform people or is it to?
Well, that's another point. Yeah. Why are we doing this? That kind of goes back to your earlier question. Yeah. Like, I mean, for me, the interviews function at a place in my own professional development.
Yeah.
So above all, I want to speak to these people.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to interview them for my own development, basically. But. Yeah, there is a point. Like, is this actually for me or is this for a general audience? I'm not sure.
It's funny. Darren Elliott, who does the Lives of Teachers podcast and video, he asked me that question recently. He said people ask me, so I'm asking, like, why do you interview these people? And we both kind of agreed. It's a chance to talk to these people.
Yeah.
I guess we are doing it. We're not just talking to these people. We are releasing it for other people to listen to. Hearing him actually sit down and talk with somebody, you do get a different side of him.
Yeah. But I think it would probably be quite strange to challenge someone, because the purpose of a podcast isn't I'm going to start this podcast and I'm going to argue with everyone.
I don't know. I think there's some people on Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is space
for that definitely.
Kind of podcast. Yeah. I don't know if it would last that long, though.
You probably wouldn't get many people.
Yeah, on. After a while, people would just stop going on it.
What did Ryuku Kubota said, like, because we've often talked about in the past, why don't we get these people together? Why don't we set up a meeting or a Skype meeting and just let them talk? And we haven't done that yet, but, you know, that's maybe something to do with our next forum at JAL, maybe. But
Do you think there would be space for kind of a debates kind of
perhaps podcast? Not a JALT, maybe.
Not a JALT.
More, more applied linguistic type conference?
Yeah, like? Maybe. I don't know. To be honest, I think people would find it very interesting. I just watched today, I don't know when it was from, but Aya Teffel posted they structured it as a debate between Peter Medjes and Alessia Kogo. Basically a debate. It was structured as a debate about ELF and Medjes getting up and talking about all the problems he had with it and Kogo talking about, you know, in support of it. And yeah, I found it very, very watchable, listenable, it was like an hour long, but I sat there and watched it. So I think there is space for that. And I think, and you know, a podcast may be a forum for that sort of thing.
Yeah. I also think, like, and this is kind of happening more now, conferences or at JAL. I mean, this is one of the reasons for doing our forum is because there's not a lot of dialogue that goes on at conferences. Like, there is in corridors, in passing, in the pub.
Yeah.
But there isn't actually any dialogic events. Like,
And I think it can be really tight if you're kind of not in the kind of in-group. I remember my first conference, like, it wasn't the organizer's fault or anything, but I just kind of turned up and I had, like, few conversations the whole weekend and often like because I wasn't working in a university lots of people are like, well, this person can't find me a job that I want, I'm not interested in talking to you, bye. So yeah, I think it is good because it kind of does open it up and it does kind of make it a lot more interactive for people.
I think it's
nice if you can't come as well. So,
right.
Another point.
I think some conferences in Japan at least have tried to move and tried to sort of create some more dialogue you know, between plenary speakers, between the speakers and audience members.
And
I think it's a good direction to go in.
Because like presentations are often one way, right? They're like articles. They're just like, here's something I've done.
Yes.
Any questions? Okay, I'm off. I'm out of here. Bye. So it would be nice to focus more on the any questions bit. Like, what, maybe we could do a flipped conference. People have started doing that, where you have you put the presentation online first, and then the session is just questions.
If someone's listening to this and they say, oh, these guys sound so awesome and so much better than Tim, I want to be a podcaster. Now that I've heard the Teflology guys. What kind of equipment do you need to set up? And what kind of equipment do you guys use?
I think the bare minimum is a computer, basically, or an iPad even. I think that this, you know, an iPad can do the job. The microphone on it is good enough, I guess, but investing in any kind of external microphone is going to start to increase the quality straight away.
I think the first microphone we brought was depending on where you're listening to this, it cost about £40, £50, which we all chipped in for, and that's done us well. You know, that's lasted the years. You know, been quite robust. We also have, for like roving interviews on the go, we have a little dictaphone that does the job. Yeah, maybe try not to worry about the equipment. Just go for the quality of the actual content.
So, like as Matt said, we originally just had one mic that we all kind of sat around. Recently, we have three mics, so we can all just kind of, you know, speak into our own mic. It makes it a slightly more comfortable experience.
Yeah.
Obviously, you need some kind of sound editing equipment, but again, you know, any computer or tablet will have that available.
Yep, you know? Like GarageBand we use.
Okay. And how much have you guys kind of, when I used to be really into photography, they used to call it GAS, gear acquisition syndrome.
Oh, right, okay.
And so you just find yourself like, oh, no, I want this one, I want this one.
We want to keep this as kind of cheap as possible for us. Because we're not, and this is a whole other topic, but the idea of sponsorship.
Yeah.
You know, if we were getting money or if we were getting sponsored for this, we might put the money back into the podcast, but we're doing this off of our own steam and our own money.
Yeah.
So we don't want to get too involved with the equipment.
Yeah, I mean, also we record in like a bunch of different places. We all currently work at different universities, and so we've recorded at all our respective universities. We've recorded at all our respective homes, conference stairwells, or you know, everywhere. Yeah. So I think that with the equipment, and you know, we just bought these three fancy new mics, and we've only used all three of them together a couple of times because one of us, usually me, forgets to bring it. So if we ended up settling on one place where we always recorded, then maybe. But
The last question was: is there anything people don't know about podcasting for English language teachers that you wish they knew?
I mean, it kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is it's hard to know what people's perception of you know the whole process is, as you know, from the listener's perception in terms of, I mean, funnily enough, like talking about where we record, I think somebody once asked us, like, you know, do you use a studio or you know this kind of stuff, and assuming that we have this very fancy setup, which we don't, and maybe there's an assumption that it requires more. It does require work, but maybe there's an assumption that it requires more money and more time and all these things than it actually does. You know, at a minimum, you can just get together with your friends anywhere in a living room, start recording, and start talking about the things that you want to talk about. So it really can be that minimal. And probably like us, you'll find that the first episode, you don't use it because it was terrible. But from that initial try, you'll start to discover what does work for you.
Yeah,
maybe one thing is just that it's possible for anybody to do.
Yeah, I think it's a great form of professional development. It's an emerging form, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I what I would tell people, though, is it does take longer than you expect to edit and do all that kind of thing. So that's one thing. Also, a lot of our colleagues, we found, they know of the podcast, but they don't want to listen. There's some kind of, I think, getting into a podcast takes a little bit more investment than looking at someone's blog or, you know, that kind of thing. There's an extra step of, you have to spend a bit of time listening. Yeah, there's that little extra step that you need to get beyond, I think. And for a lot of our colleagues that we know, they would prefer not to hear our voices more when they go home. But I'd say give it a go. Stick with it, maybe. I think that's the thing with any podcast, really. You've got to get through that initial first podcast. Oh, I'm not sure if I like this.
Yeah. And if you do decide to start a podcast, I think, I mean, going back to what we were talking about right at the beginning in terms of all those podcasts that started and then flamed out after a few episodes, which is the most important thing. And I think it helps, for us at least, it helps having three of us to kind of watch each other. Mm. But I don't think we've missed a month since we started.
We've done it fortnightly for 4 years, almost 5 years.
And sometimes that's, you know, recording a few at a time and having a backlog when we know we won't be able to meet for a while. I think the consistency is a pretty important factor, and just you know,
and what do you think kind of drives that consistency? Is it just the rapport and friendship, or
I think discipline. I think we always contact. It's changed over time, you know. Rob used to be on our backs, we need to record an episode, that's kind of fallen over to me now, and maybe it will go to Matt. And well, basically the main take home is we all get on each other's backs.
But it's, what's interesting is that, I mean, I think we are maybe planning to take a break finally soon,
possibly.
But a short break. But I think it's a good question, what keeps us doing it. Because I think, I mean, I guess we know the numbers of people who listen, and we're aware that we're a very niche product. You know, I guess there's a lot of language teachers in the world, but of those language teachers, the one who listen to podcasts, and of those ones who listen to podcasts, the ones who want to listen to a podcast about language teaching, it's, you know, we're aware that there's probably a cap of on how many people are going to listen to us. But to be honest, I think, you know, when we did start getting feedback, when we got, you know, the first couple of emails from people who we didn't know, saying, I listened to it, I enjoyed it. Even if it is just a couple of people listening, I think that's sort of enough for us.
Yeah, I mean, we met a listener, didn't we? A listener came over, not especially to see us, but he came over to Japan from Korea, and he wanted to meet up with us. And we sat down and had a meal with him, and he told us how much, how important the podcast has been for him in his life. And yeah, it's amazing. Like that was, we never set out with that in mind. But that's something that motivates us now, I think. That's only one person so far.
Well, you motivated me to start a podcast.
There you go.
That's two. All right. Okay. Let's go get a beer.
Sure.
Yeah.
for listening. Make sure you check out the Tefillology podcast and their book, Podcasting and Professional Development, a guide for English language teachers. You can find links to both of those in the description. I'll be back next week talking about my experience studying a master's in applied linguistics and my research I presented a few weeks ago in Cambodia.
Whiskey, soda, rock and roll.